Before modern agriculture and food preservation methods came into effect, and I heard an announcement just the other day that some company now is preparing food that will last for 25 years, which is an amazing accomplishment, but nevertheless, they say they can do that. But prior to those agricultural advancements and food preservation ideas came along, famine was a rather common experience in the world in which people lived. The Bible talks about famines, and very often they were a result of one of two things. One was of war. Very often the enemy would come in and destroy the crops, creating a famine and help to defeat that country. If you remember in our study of Samson, on one occasion, Samson, as retribution for some of his problems, collected a number of foxes, tied their tails together with a firebrand in between them, and turned them loose in the fields of the Philistines. That was not only his retribution, but it was also an act of war to bring the Philistines to their knees through a famine when their food crops were destroyed. So warfare was one of the reasons that famines came. Another one was just natural disasters. We still have famines in different places. But the Bible records a number of famines that occurred. For example, over in Genesis, the 12th chapter, we read about a famine during the time of Abraham. And Abraham and Sarah went down into Egypt because Egypt had food, and there was food there, and so they went down there looking for food. And that, of course, was one of the times that Abraham and Sarah got into trouble because they would not divulge who Sarah really was, the wife of Abraham. That's an interesting story. But it's also very interesting to me that a few chapters later, in Genesis, the 26th chapter, Isaac and Rebekah had the same problem. There was a famine during their time, and they went down into Egypt, and the very same thing happened again, in which Isaac was not honest about who his wife really was. Then there was a third famine that we read about in the Bible, and that's over in Genesis, the 26th chapter, and this is in the time of Isaac. And in this case, I mentioned he created or he duplicated the same sin that his father did with regarding his wife. Then in Genesis 41, there's another famine that's recorded, but this famine was a little bit different. This famine had been prophesied by Joseph. Now Joseph at this time was down in Egypt because he had been sold by his brethren to owners in Egypt, but he became very well known in Egypt because he prophesied that there was going to be a famine. Not only was it coming, but he was able to predict that it was going to come in 7 years, that there would be 7 years of plenty and then there would be 7 years of famine. And so as a result of his prophecy coming to pass, Pharaoh put a great deal of confidence into Isaac and said, you know, get us ready for this. And certainly Joseph did that. And so after the 7 years of plenty and the years of famine came, there was famine in all the countries around Egypt. And that brings me to the lesson for today. Concerning this famine, Jacob said to his sons, who were suffering from a lack of food, he says to them in Genesis 42 and verse 1, a very important statement, "Why do you look one upon another? Behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. get you down thither and buy for from thence that we may live and not die. To me, that's an outstanding statement coming from Jacob. Why do you stand here looking one upon another when there's corn and food down in Egypt? Let's go down there and buy it that we can live. What a prophetic kind of wisdom that Jacob shows at that time. The question asked of his sons, why do you look one on another, would be expressed today in our modern terms, in such terms as, don't just stand there, do something. Or number two, get busy, there's a work that's got to be done before we die. Or three, what are you waiting for? There's food in Egypt, let's go down there and buy it that we might live. The attitude of the sons of Jacob resembled the attitude of the apostles. And there was another question asked of them in the New Testament. Over in Matthew 14, verse 15, you recall that Jesus is ascending back into heaven. The apostles are standing around watching as he goes back into heaven. But there's an angel that's also standing by. And the angel says to them, ye men of Galilee, why stand you gazing up into heaven? This same Jesus, which is taken up from you into heaven, shall so come in like manner, and as ye have seen him go into heaven. Again, it seems like the angel is saying to the apostles, why are you standing around gazing up into heaven? This Jesus is going to come back, but there's work to be done now, and you need to be busy rather than standing and gazing into heaven. During the ministry of Jesus, there was another time that the apostles were involved in similar kinds of speech. The attitude on that occasion was Jesus was preaching and the multitudes came. And it got time for dinner time, or as we'd say, supper. And the apostles came to Jesus and they said, you know, what are we going to do? We're out here in this wilderness location and these people are hungry. What are we going to do? We don't have anything to feed them with. And again, Jesus says to them, what do you have? And they said, well, we've got 5 loaves and 2 fish. And so Jesus took that and fed the multitude. But again, it was the same attitude. You know, what are we going to do, Lord? All these people are here and we don't have any food and we don't know what to do. And Jesus says, yes, you need to use what you have rather than asking, you know, or saying we can do nothing. It seems to me that the angel's question and the question that they ask of Jesus exhibit for us a word or two of wisdom when they said, why do you look one upon another? And the conditions that surround such a situation would cause us to begin to say, well, what can I do? What do I need to do with regard to this situation? Jacob's question then has, I think, a number of lessons that we need to be reminded of. And one of them is that that such situations that they were in require leadership. In other words, there needs to be some kind of leadership and initiative to say, hey, here's the problem, here's what we need to do with regard to that problem. It's interesting to me that Jacob says to the sons, you know, why are you looking one on another? Let's go down into Egypt and buy corn. The sons lacked vision and they lacked leadership. I can just see them standing around saying, well, what are we going to do? You know, it's a famine out there and we don't have any food. They lacked vision and they lacked leadership and initiative in getting something done. Now that's ironic to me because a few years before, when their envy of their brother reached its boiling point, they had no problem coming up with a solution. They said, "We'll kill him." And then when that somebody said, "No, we can't kill him. Well, we'll throw him in a pit and leave him." No, that's not too good. Well, if we can't do that, we'll sell him to slaveholders who are going down into Egypt. We'll get rid of him that way. It's ironic to me that here in a famine, where his father was concerned about the family dying of starvation, they're saying, "What are we going to do?" They couldn't come up with a thing. But earlier, they came up with all kinds of ideas as to what could be done with regard to their envy of their brother Joseph. That tells me that we see what we want to see. They could see all kinds of answers to their envy of Joseph. But on this particular occasion of the famine, they couldn't see anything that might be done. It's interesting that Jesus, as he portrayed the judgment scene, there was a group on the left and a group on the right, and to one group he said, "You know, I was sick and I was hungry and I was in prison and naked, and you didn't come to me, you didn't clothe me." You know what their answer was? "Lord, when did we see you that way? We never saw you hungry. We never saw you in prison. We never saw you naked." There has to be vision in order for us to do the will of our God. And Jesus went on to say, "You know, I was sick and I was, and you didn't come and help me." So we see what we want to see, and in fact, I guess the bottom line is we do what we want to do. They found something to do with their brother, and so it is with us today. As we look around, you know, what can I do with regard to the problems that are before us? The need for food in Jacob's household was acute, and all they could do was look at one another. And say, "Well, you know, what are we going to do?" And Joseph, or Jacob rather, gives them an answer. Somebody has said that doing nothing has never produced anything. And every successful accomplishment has a beginning with one step. There's a Chinese proverb that says a journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. And that one step, my friends, is a matter of faith in the process that is before us. There are more good deeds that are destroyed by a lack of faith than any other thing I can think of with regard to us doing good works. Doing nothing is the easiest alternative. Again, if you think about it, the doing nothing will escape us from any criticism. It will also result in us doing nothing, saying nothing, and being nothing. So there must be then some vision, there must be some activity, some initiative, some leadership if there's going to be progress made. Each of Jacob's sons was waiting for others to lead the way. Their inactivity proved Jacob to say, "Why do you look one upon another? I have heard there's corn in Egypt. Go ye down thither and buy for us." But what are some other lessons that we can learn from this event right here at Oceanside? And the first one I would mention for you this morning is that for the church to go forward, there must be leadership. Somebody's got to take the initiative and provide leadership in order for it to be accomplished. God planned for that. God knew that there had to be leadership, and therefore he instituted the office of elders, 1 Peter 5, verses 1 through 4. To have leadership, though, there has to be fellowship. If you have leadership and nobody's following, you really don't have leadership. So it requires not only that the church to move forward has to have leadership, but there must be fellowship in order for the church to move forward. I get amused sometimes at politics, but I hear politicians talk about leading from behind. I don't know how you do that. The word leadership carries with it the idea that somebody's out in front, not in the back. But nevertheless, leadership from behind. Well, maybe that's possible, but I don't know how you do that. Leadership says it's got to be forward motion. Let me stop and make a caution here. There has to be leadership. But again, because I do not agree with that leadership, doesn't mean that I strike out on my own. Just because I don't agree with the set that the leadership has set, it does not authorize me to say, well, if they're not going to do it, I don't agree with what they're doing, I'm going to do it on my own. That's not the way it operates. If we disagree with leadership, then we need to explain the disagreement and why, and then allow the leadership to take the initiative and move us forward. There's an outstanding example of that over in the book of Numbers, chapter 16. God had appointed Moses and Aaron from the tribe of Levi to lead the children of Israel. They had led them through all kinds of conflicts. And at this time, there was a man named Korah. Now, Korah was of the family of Levi, too. So he was of the priesthood family. And Korah enlists 250 men. And they all went to Moses and Aaron and said, you know, who made you leader? What do you think you're doing? And they led a rebellion against Aaron and Moses. The Bible says that they rebelled against God. Now, how could that be? Because God had appointed Aaron and Moses to lead the children of Israel. But you know, to show the disgust of God at that action, of them rebelling against the leadership that God had appointed, the ground opened up, and Korah and his followers were swallowed up. And if that was not enough, their families were swallowed up and their possessions were swallowed up. Leadership is important, but it must be used as God would have it to be. And so there has to be leadership, and that was not obvious with the sons of Jacob. The incident of the famine in Jacob's time emphasizes the need for vision. Somebody's got to look around and say, well, here are some solutions to this problem. The son said, we don't know what we're going to do. We don't know what alternatives we have. They were just looking among themselves for somebody to do something. There has to be a vision for there to be progress made. If my mind can conceive it, somebody has said, I can achieve it. Somebody's got to think ahead and say, well, we could do this, we could do that, or whatever. And if we can conceive it, then we can achieve it. The sons apparently could not visualize, could not even think of going down into Egypt and buying corn and bringing it back for food to their family. I wonder sometimes, I don't know about you, but there are times that I wonder, what will Oceanside be in 5 years? What will Oceanside be in 10 years? What will Oceanside be in 20 years? somebody's got to be thinking and visualizing what Oceanside is going to be and working toward that goal. Vision is necessary for life. The wise man said, where there is no vision, the people perish. We cannot live in the past. There has to be vision toward the future. What do we want Oceanside to be in the coming years? The past is valuable, some say, as a guidepost, but it is dangerous as a hitching post. We must look forward to the future and what we would like to see occur within ourselves and within the church. That's exactly the reason that we have a Catch a Vision Day. It's a time that the church can come together and say, here are some things that I'm thinking about that maybe we ought to be doing. There has to be vision in our lives or we perish. And Catch a Vision is an opportunity for us to do that. Catch a Vision was an opportunity and is an opportunity for the dreamers to have their say. I would love to see us with a membership of X number. I'd love to see us do this, or I'd love to see us do that. That's what Catch a Vision is all about. It's about vision and catching a vision and coming up with a solution to solve some need that we might have. But we also learn from Jacob's sons that not only does there have to be a vision, somebody to see ahead and say, well, we need to do this or that, but there's got to be action. It doesn't do any good, my brethren, to sit into a Catch a Vision Day, say we need to do this, and sit back and do nothing. There has to be a plan, and that plan has been developed. But there has to be activity, and there has to be action to implement the plan, whatever it may be. This is emphasized so strongly in the book of James. In James, the second chapter, beginning in verse 14, when James asks the question, what doth it profit, my brethren, though a man say he hath faith and have not works, can faith save him? If a brother or sister is naked and in distress or in destitute of daily food, and one of you say unto them, depart in peace, be ye warmed and filled, notwithstanding ye give them not those things which are needful to the body, what doth it profit? In other words, you see a need out there, and here's the need staring you in the face, and you say, well, you know, you go and be warmed, and you go and be filled. That profits nothing. Action and vision go together. Vision without action is of no profit, James says. Jesus described the Pharisees on one occasion by saying, you do what they say, but don't do what they do, because they say and do not. That emphasizes, I think, as plainly as we can, that to have a vision or to know what is good and not do it will not profit us one thing. Now, we've talked about the Bible example. I'd like for us to talk about some other examples that exist even today in our modern society. For example, the question comes up, why do we look one upon another with regard to teaching the lost? You start talking about evangelism. That's okay. Yeah, we got the preacher. We're paying some missionaries. We're paying for house to house and all of these other things of question. Aren't we looking to somebody else to do the evangelism? In Mark 16 and 15, the command was given to go into all the world and preach the gospel. Who was that to? Was that to the preacher or was that to the elder? Sure, it was to them. But it was to every Christian that we were to go into all the world and preach the gospel. I guess the question really is, why do we look one on another in regard to, and when we put personal evangelism in front of it, then that becomes a real hot topic. But really, that's what it's about. The evangelism that Jesus talked about was not just the 12 apostles. It was all of those early churches and early Christians that were involved in that evangelism that he required. Here's another question. Why do we look one on another in regard to our own spiritual growth? Well, you know, I believe this or that, or I haven't heard a sermon on this, or haven't heard that, or whatever. Does that excuse us for our own personal spiritual growth? Do we need to look at somebody else to help us grow when we have the Word? And it's very simple for us to understand and know what God would have us to do. But nevertheless, the sons were sitting around waiting for someone else to do what they needed to do themselves. I guess the bottom line is really, if you stop and look at it personally, if you're not a better Christian today than you were yesterday, you're not making progress. If you don't know more about the Bible today than you did yesterday or last week, then you're not making any progress. Why do we look one on another with regard to my own personal, spiritual knowledge and growth? It's a personal responsibility as well as help from others. Another question. Why do we look one upon another with regard to salvation? I remember years ago, a group of young people who were at the age of accountability. And there was a lot of discussion among those young people, but the discussion went like this. I'll go forward if you'll go forward. That's not what it's about. It is a personal commitment. The real statement should be, I'll go forward even if you don't go forward. But those people were looking to someone else with regard to their own salvation in obeying the gospel. But it goes further than that. There's some who say, well, I'm as good as he or she is. You're telling me I'm doing something I shouldn't be doing. But look at them, look what they're doing. I'm as good as they are. Is that not the same problem we're talking about? Looking one upon another with regard to our own salvation. Another question, why do we look one on another with regard to the teaching and training of our children? There are people who criticize the church. Well, those Sunday school teachers, you know, they're not doing a good job. The preacher, he needs to preach on this. But where is the parent's responsibility with regard to the teaching of their children, with regard to spiritual matters? In fact, in Ephesians, the 6th chapter, Paul there places the emphasis squarely on one individual, and that is husbands. Ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. So I guess the question we're facing this morning is, why do we look one on another with regard to teaching and training our children? I'll never forget a conversation I had years ago with the dean at David Lipscomb College, and we were talking about students who come to Lipscomb, and he made this statement. By the way, this was when Lipscomb was a tried and true Christian college. But he made this statement. He said, you know, there are many, many parents who send their children to Lipscomb in order to convert them and to train them in the Bible. Well, that may be true. But he went on to say, you know, they expect Lipscomb or a Christian college to do something in 4 years that they could not do in 18 years? And that's a good question. Why do we look upon others with regard to the training of our children? There is so much to be done in the work of the Lord today, even right here at Oceanside. But unless we rid ourselves of the attitude of looking to others, the job will never get done. That attitude, by the way, is expressed in the language that we use. There are some who talk about they down at the church. They don't do this. They don't do that. I don't know why they do that. That's the wrong attitude. The attitude is we. If we're doing something wrong, then we need to address it. If there's something that we need to do, we need to address it. But the attitude of we versus they is an attitude that will cripple any work that needs to be done. There's a lot to be done, brethren, right here at Oceanside. We beg for people to take part in the work of the church here, preparing the communion, teaching classes, doing visiting, making calls, doing writing letters and cards to missing members and so on. There's a ton of things to do. Somebody's got to stop looking around at others and say, here am I. You know, I'll be involved. I'll do my part in that particular work. The theme, we've talked about Catch a Vision. But the theme for this year is I am resolved. I don't know if you've thought about that or not, but I is a personal pronoun. I am resolved. Now that's one case where it's really not we, it's I. It's a personal commitment. I am resolved. Well, what does resolve mean? Resolve means to make a firm personal decision. I've made up my mind. I will do this or that. There's a lot to do. You say, well, we don't have very many. We have a lot of older members. That's true. But where is the vision? Where is the plan? Where is the activity to overcome that problem? I trust this morning that I have encouraged you to make a personal decision to do more for the Lord this year than you have in the past. If we work together, if we're united, we can overcome any obstacle. God will be with us in those good deeds, but there has to be vision, there has to be fellowship and leadership, and there has to be an active plan and an involvement of the individual involved. We need to make decisions that I will be resolved to be involved in the coming year. Over in Mark, the 8th chapter, verse 36, Jesus asked the question, for what shall it profit a man if he gain the whole world and lose his own soul? For what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? That's a monumental question. What would we put in place of our personal involvement in the work of the church and be lost? If you're here and you're not a Christian, you need to be. We want you to be. Not only that, but God wants you to be. He wants you to believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He wants you to be willing to change the way you live by repentance. He wants you to confess publicly, not privately or in secret, but publicly, that you believe in Jesus Christ and you're committing your life to Him. And then to be buried in baptism for the forgiveness of all of your past sins. And I said all of them that we repent of. If you're not a Christian, we want you to be. That's the whole purpose of us being here. Not only to encourage each other, but to offer the opportunity for you to give a commitment and resolve to live for Jesus. Maybe you started it out and somehow you've gotten deterred to looking to other people to do some very important things. Won't you change today? Won't you commit yourself to be personally resolved in doing what God would have us to do? If you need to come, now's the time to do it. Let us stand as we sing.